You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
Good afternoon and welcome to Soul to Soul. And we are continuing with our crash course in Jewish history, which is really fascinating. And as we always say, when one looks into history and sees what's happened to the Jewish people, it really speaks for itself and says a tremendous amount as to where we are today and where we're going as our nation. Last week we discussed the Spanish Inquisition and the Black Death, the bubonic plague in Europe, and how both of them had tremendous impacts on the Sephardi and Ashkenazi Jewish communities respectively, caused a lot of upheaval for the Jewish people at that time. And the Jews therefore in Europe went further east and went to Poland, to Lithuania, to Ukraine, and that was the beginnings in the 14th century of the development of the Jewish communities in Eastern Europe. And many of us, most of us here in South Africa, are descendants of Lithuanian Jewry, and that's how the Jews ended up in Lithuania. Unfortunately, however, the general pattern of Jewish history applied to Eastern Europe as well, and that is at first the Jews are invited and are welcomed and are given protection and encouragement by the authorities. And then after about 300 years, things begin to turn sour and the Jews find themselves in a more difficult situation where they're persecuted and where they're faced with pogroms and anti-Semitism. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened in Eastern Europe. In the year 1648, there was a uprising, a rebellion of the Ukrainian peasants against the Polish aristocracy, and the rebellion was led by Bogdan Khmelnytsky. And as we discussed last time, Jews found themselves a little bit in between the aristocracy and the peasants, and therefore they were prime targets of this rebellion. And 250,000 Jews were killed in Eastern Europe between 1648 and 1651. And there was about 7% of the Jewish population, which was about 5 million in Eastern Europe at that time, which is a massive amount of Jews that were killed. And it really was the beginning of the downhill experience for the Jewish people in Eastern Europe, which culminated in the total annihilation of East European Jewry with the Holocaust 300 years later. It's also important to bear in mind when we're looking at this period in the history of the world, that it's the time of the Renaissance. The Renaissance was began in the around about the 14th century and continued till the 17th century. And the Renaissance was a new way of seeing the world and seeing life. They were coming out of the Middle Ages in Europe. And the Renaissance actually means rebirth. It was a rebirth of the ideas of ancient Rome, of ancient Greece. And one of the results of the Renaissance was a undermining of the church in Europe. And when the church was undermined, so it meant that all religious infrastructure and institutions were challenged. We see that the discovery, the verification of the fact that the earth was not the center of the universe, but rather the planets revolved around the sun, which that was proved by Copernicus. When that happened, so it was a major challenge to the church, because they always said that everything revolved around the earth, and people began to question if they were wrong about that. Maybe they're wrong about many more things as well. And of course that had a major impact on the Jewish world as well. And that's actually one of the great dangers within science, is that there are many different theories, and different theories take hold at different times. And as we move on, so the previous theories are disproved and new theories come around. So for us as Jews to latch onto or to be in sync with one particular theory is a dangerous thing, because that theory may be proven to be obsolete and incorrect in a few years' time. So although Judaism is very much compatible with science and scientific theories, we don't pull all our eggs in one basket and realize that science changes, but the truth of the Torah doesn't change. We see, though, however, that also at that time, Europe was wrecked by the war of the Protestants, the Protestant Reformation, and so the church really was plagued and was on the defensive, and these new ideas of the Renaissance were now emerging into the world. In the late 1600s and 1700s arose the ideas of enlightenment, what we call in Hebrew Haskalah. The enlightenment came about in Western Europe, later spread to Eastern Europe. It was based on the idea that religion is not a good thing, but rather religion is a bad thing, and that religion hinders the progress of humanity, and that the world is better without religion. The ideas of the Enlightenment and of democracy, of freedom, of which really were the basis of Western culture, they began to take hold in England, in France, in Germany, in the New World. And so by the early 1700s, large portions of Europe were now non-believers. And coming out of the Middle Ages, where everybody was a believer, there was a major departure. And not only did it affect the non-Jewish world, but of course it affected the Jewish world as well. Because previously the Torah was at the center of Jewish life, the rabbis had a powerful position, and were supreme in the Jewish world. But now there was a new culture, and it had with it many changes, and religion was rejected primarily by this new wave of enlightenment. And interestingly, we see that the founding fathers of the United States were all students of the Enlightenment. They were all non-believers. And the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights were established to protect the population, the civilians, against state religion. So we see that Jefferson, that Benjamin Franklin, that Thomas Paine, Alexander Hamilton, who, by the way, was descendant of Jews, they were all non-believers. And the ideas of the Declaration of Independence are ideas of enlightenment, that all men are equal, that government should not force things, and that should be the underpinning of the society. And it actually helps us understand very clearly that the liberal movement, which in our times has become quite radical and quite extreme, has its roots and was born in these ideas of enlightenment. The way the Jewish world and the traditional Jewish world will deal with these new ideas and with the enlightenment throughout the world is really a primary question that has been the central question within the Jewish world the last 300 years. How is it that we reconcile these ideas of modernity with traditional Jewish life, with observance of the mitzvahs of God's commandments? In fact, Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch did a wonderful job of showing how really these ideas of enlightenment have their source and their root in the Torah. And they all come from these ideas of compassion, of understanding, of empathy, of the rights of all, are actually from the Torah itself. Rav Hirsch shows it very clearly. But it really is the major question, has been for the last 300 years, on how we sync the two and straddle the two worlds. And although we live in a modern, technologically advanced world, the center of our world is still dedication to God and the performance of mitzvahs. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
Ironically, we see that the place in which the Enlightenment took hold first in Europe was Germany. And Germany became the most liberal state of all the European countries. Really, Germany itself was a confederate of many different states. And in Germany, we see that the Jews were given rights and given opportunities before any other country in Europe, which is quite ironic, isn't it? The first place where Jews became citizens, they were given equal rights, they were able to attend universities, they were given commercial rights, that was all in Germany. And therefore, it's the first community, the German Jewish community, that struck with this conflict of modernity and finding a compromise and a balance between the modern world and our traditional Jewish outlook and values. The father of the Enlightenment in Germany was a person by the name of Moses Mendelssohn. Mendelssohn was, interestingly, quite a strange-looking person. He was a bit of a hunchback. In fact, the Prussian emperor said of Mendelssohn, "Never have I seen such great wine is in such an ugly vessel." Mendelssohn was a great Talmud Chochem, a great Torah scholar. We have letters in which he wrote to the leading Rabbonim of the time, in which they responded with great respect to him and to his ideas in terms of understanding Jewish law and Talmud. Mendelssohn was a genius, and we often find the problem with geniuses is they think everybody else is a genius. When you have a professor who's a real genius and he gives a course at university, so he can't understand why it is that his students don't get the complicated theory the first time around. And if they don't understand it, say, you know, what right do they have to be alive anyway? That's unfortunately the case with many geniuses, and they assume everybody else is a genius. Mendelssohn made the fatal assumption that if he could be Moses Mendelssohn and he could be a friend of the Crown Prince of Prussia and he could graduate from the best university in Germany and he could write books in philosophy and at the same time never miss davening mincha in a minyan and write a commentary on the Chumash, on the Torah, and be in correspondence with all the great Talmidei Chachamim of the time, he said that if he was able to pull off that seamless trick, so everybody else should be able to do so as well. And he didn't see what a problem this would be for the average person. He didn't even see it in his own family. Unfortunately, Mendelssohn's six children, four of them converted to Christianity, and he had no Jewish grandchildren. He had zero Jewish grandchildren, which is such an unbelievable tragedy. And although he thought it was possible for Jews to be able to find that balance, he was horribly wrong, and right very close to home in his own family, he saw how horribly wrong he was. Mendelssohn really opened the door for Reform Judaism. Reform Judaism is based on the idea that because of the Enlightenment, because Jews now have civil rights and Jews have a chance to become part of the civil society, especially after Meir Amschel Rothschild established his bank in Frankfurt in the 1760s, and Jews were now recognized as legitimate financiers. Because all of this, so the Reform movement said that we have to give up the old and embrace the new. First, they said we have to give up the old dress. The old Jewish traditional garb had to go. Then they said we have to give up the old language. Yiddish should not be spoken, only German. We have to give up the day of rest. And Shabbos, Saturday, is not when the society takes off their day of rest. It needs to be Sunday, in sync with the rest of the population. And the synagogue also then has to look like the church, etc., etc. So Reform basically were giving everything away until by the early 19th century, there's no vestige of Judaism left amongst the observers, the followers of Reform. And to be in tune with Enlightenment, they had the slogan. The slogan said that we are embracing, we accept prophetic Judaism, and we reject rabbinic Judaism. What is rabbinic Judaism? Rabbinic Judaism is the Talmud, is the Torah Shebaal Peh, the oral tradition, it's the Shulchan Aruch, it's the code of Jewish law, the mitzvahs, observing the mitzvahs. They said all of that is now obsolete in our modern world where Jews have civil rights. And the ideas of the prophets, they are still relevant to our time. The ideas of social justice, the ideas of equality, of compassion. So their Judaism really became a form of liberal Christianity. That's how the Reform movement turned out. And that's why we see there was a massive wave of conversions from Judaism to Christianity in the 1700s. As we know, conversion usually solves very few problems and brings many new problems, to the fore. So that's, pretty much what happened to German Jewry. And these ideas of Enlightenment did not yet reach East European Jewry. That would take a little bit longer, which we will get to in a moment. The Jews of Eastern Europe at the time in the 1700s, in the 18th century, were depressed. They were extremely poor and impoverished. They hadn't yet recovered from the pogroms of Khmelnytsky. They were still reeling from the Shabbatai Tzvi controversy. And so the Jews in Eastern Europe were in a very dark place. And many Jews were on the verge of losing their connection to Judaism and of leaving behind our holy tradition. And into this void, in the 1700s, came the movement of Hasidus, which revolutionized the Jewish world. Hasidus spread across Poland and Ukraine. Only in Litta, in Lithuania, and in Latvia, did it not take deep root because of the opposition of the Vilna Gaon. But in the other parts of Eastern Europe, Hasidus really saved the Jewish world. And Hasidus was a movement led by the Baal Shem Tov, in which there was a new approach to understanding Judaism. It was an understanding of deeper Kabbalistic spiritual ideas, more of a focus of joy and simcha. And the Baal Shem Tov's revolution really transformed East European Jewry and was essential to saving East European Jewry. By the beginning of the 19th century, the ideas of enlightenment also reached Eastern Europe. In the long history of the Jewish people, the Torah always had a good response to every challenge, whether it was from the Greeks or the Romans or the Christians or the Muslims. But the challenge of modernity was a bit of a more difficult one to respond to. And that really, as I mentioned earlier, is the pinnacle issue in the Jewish world. How do we balance the Jewish way of life and at the same time still remain loyal to our holy tradition and to the commandments that God gave us? We live in a modern, technologically advanced world, and that's something that we constantly are grappling with and of trying to find that balance. When the ideas of enlightenment did arrive in Eastern Europe, they came with Napoleon. When Napoleon invaded in 1812 and headed towards Russia and Eastern Europe, really that was Napoleon's undoing. No one has ever defeated Russia. Russia is just too big. No one's able to swallow it. Russia can only really defeat itself, which it's done a number of times. But from the outside, Russia is pretty much impregnable. We saw that in World War II, the German army destroyed a third of Russia, of the Russian army, captured a third of Russian territory, 40% of the Russian population was under German control, and the Germans still lost the war to Russia, to the Russians. So when Napoleon was defeated in Russia and the Grand Army limped back, they left behind the ideas of the French Revolution and the ideas of modernity. And there was a dispute amongst the great Hasidic Rabbonim about whom they should support. Should they support Napoleon, who promised civil rights and to remove the oppression of the Tsar, which well, the Tsar's oppression was extreme and very difficult to live under, was really terrible. So should they support Napoleon, who would give the Jews rights, or should they support the Tsar, as evil as he is, but the dangers of Napoleon is the new ideas of the modern world and the secularization of the Jewish people. And in fact, the Baal HaTanya, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, Roshner Zalman, said that we should support the Tsar, as difficult as that is and as evil as he is. He was very concerned that Napoleon's ideas would cause the secularization of the Jewish people. And we see that is what happened in the 20th century. He saw it exactly right, the Baal HaTanya. If we look at the modern world, the Western world, and we look at the levels of assimilation within the Western world, today in the United States, out of the Orthodox community, there's a 70% rate of assimilation. In other words, 70% of Jews are marrying non-Jews. So the Jewish people is hemorrhaging in the Western world at a very rapid rate. And the Baal HaTanya saw that coming. And so when the Haskalah arrived in Eastern Europe, it was different. The nature of the Haskalah in Eastern Europe was different to that of Western Europe. In Western Europe, it was an intention to give in and to assimilate entirely into Western European culture and civilization. In Eastern Europe, the approach of the Haskalah was not that the Jews should become Russians or they should become Poles or they should become Ukrainians, but rather the focus was the development of a new Jew, as the Zionist organization called it later, the Zionist movement called it later on, the new Jew. In other words, the slogan that they used, the Maskilim in the Haskalah, in the Enlightenment in Eastern Europe, was that the Jew needs to now be like everybody else in the street. In other words, when he's out in the street, he blends into society, and when the Jew's at home, so he can still be a Jew at home. They said, "Tehei ben Adam b'tzeisecha, v'yehudi b'beisecha." Be a human being when you're out in the street, and you can still be a Jew at home. And that was a very popular slogan at the time. But we see now, when we look back with 200 years later, with perfect hindsight, that the descendants of those who followed the Haskalah, they very rarely ended up being Jewish. If a person was not a Jew on the outside, so they ended up being also not being a Jew on the inside as well. There's a famous statement of Rabbi Shlomo Kolibach. Rabbi Kolibach was a musical genius, and he went very often to university campuses around the world to try and teach Jews about Judaism. And he used to say that he would ask the students, what their religion was. When a person said, "I'm a Catholic," you knew that they were a Catholic. Person said, "I'm a Protestant," you knew they were a Protestant. Person said, "I'm a Muslim," you knew they were a Muslim. When a person said, "I'm a human being," you knew that they were a Jew. And that's very much captures what the Haskalah was about, was to try and assimilate into the broader society. These experiences within Sephardi Jewry were very different. In other words, Sephardi Jewry didn't go through much of the trauma that Ashkenazi Jewry went through, and the Sephardi Jews were not secularized like the Ashkenazim. In the last 250 years, the Sephardi Jews escaped the trauma that the Ashkenazi Jews went through, the upheavals of the Haskalah, the open pogroms in Europe, the destruction that the Jewish community faced as a result of World War I, the annihilation of the Holocaust and World War II. Apart from the Jews in Salonika, the Sephardi Jews were pretty much untouched by all of these events. And that should give us a lot of insight into the differences between Sephardim and Ashkenazim, where the backgrounds are very different. Ashkenazi come from 200 years of turmoil and tragedy. And that's why us Ashkenazim are pretty much neurotic. And we're coming in with a lot of baggage. And it really explains a lot about the Jewish world and about the Ashkenazi Jewish world, and also about the Sephardi Jewish world, which is much healthier and has a much stronger connection to the Masorah tradition, to the our holy tradition of Judaism. We see that one of the things the Haskalah did is it also revived the Hebrew language. And part of the new Jew meant that there has to be a new language that the Jews spoke, and that was modern Hebrew. The Haskalah's view of Yiddish was that it was old-fashioned, that it represented the ancient past and the suffering of the Jews, and therefore Hebrew had to be developed. And Hebrew came with it a whole new, with Hebrew was a whole new culture, a culture that was free of Torah, in fact a culture that was anti-Torah. And we see today still the aftermath of this situation, that there are many communities within the Jewish world that they don't speak modern Hebrew. They specifically speak Yiddish because modern Hebrew represented the Haskalah and those that were anti-Torah and fought against the Torah. The majority of the Jews in Europe were affected by the Haskalah. The Haskalah was strong. The Enlightenment was strong, and it was had a very strong pull. And the traditional Jewish world found it very challenging to deal with, and had to come up with ways of facing these new changes and these differences that were approaching the Jewish world. We will discuss some of those changes, some of those approaches to the Haskalah when we return in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
We're discussing how the Haskalah spread across the Enlightenment and the ideas of Enlightenment, which really are the foundation of Western society, Western culture of the modern world. They swept across the modern world, the new world, and the old world, and the Jewish community had to deal with it. The traditional Jewish communities of Eastern and Western Europe had to find ways of confronting this new way of life, this new way of seeing the world. One of the primary responses to the Enlightenment, to the Haskalah, was the establishment of the Yeshiva movement. After the death of the Vilna Gaon in 1797, we as Litvaks know that the Gaon was one of the great individuals that led the Jewish people in the 18th century. The Gaon, he was called a Gaon because the Gaonim actually were 1,000 years before, but his Torah knowledge and his incredible genius and piety and holiness was from a time, an era, a period before, you know, that was before the 19th century. That's how holy and great he was, the Gaon of Vilna. And upon his death, one of his primary disciples, Rabbi Chaim of Volozhin, carried on the Gaon's approach. Now, in those days, the primary disciple didn't mean like today we have a Rebbe and a Talmud. The Rebbe and the Talmud learns from the Rebbe. He learns, he has a shiur from him every day, sees him regularly. The Rabbi Chaim probably saw the Vilna Gaon maybe once a year. But he took on his outlook, his worldview, and his approach to the Jewish people in those times, and he was the one who would carry that forward into the next generation. The Vilna Gaon had an idea to change the method of teaching Torah within Klal Yisrael, within the Jewish world. There had always been yeshivot in Europe, in Eastern Europe, and the yeshivot were usually run by the Rav of the town. So the way it worked was that all the young boys would be in cheder, and they would probably be in cheder till the age of 11 or 12, until just before their bar mitzvah. They would learn to read, they'd learn a basic literacy within Jewish texts. And then if they were not very good, if they were not shown to be smart and didn't show potential in their learning, so they went out to work. So we see that they were going out to work at the age of 12 before their bar mitzvah. Those that had more promise would stay on and learn with the rabbi of their town for a few more years, usually till the age of 15 or so. If they then continued to show great promise, that rabbi would send them to bigger rabbis of bigger towns. And if they were good, but they weren't outstanding, so then they also would go out to work at the age of 15. That's pretty much how things functioned, in the 17th and 18th, the 18th and 19th centuries, within the Jewish world. The 17th, 18th century, sorry. So now this is the beginning of the 19th century. And, the Gaon saw that things had to change. Reb Chaim Volozhin, his Talmud, understood that very well. And Reb Chaim wrote a famous letter in 1803, the beginning of the 19th century, in which he addressed the Rabbonim of the time, the main Rabbonim that were in Lithuania at the time. And in this letter, Reb Chaim said the following. He said that the Torah is disappearing from the Jewish world, that the old system is failing, and the Haskalah is going to take away all the best minds within the Jewish people. And he said, Torah, ma'ati alea. What's going to be with the Torah? What's going to be with the Holy Torah? And how's it going to be passed on to the next generation? So he said, I'm going to make a yeshiva for the best and brightest minds of Lita, of Lithuania. And Reb Chaim said, I expect all of you to support my endeavor, to support my yeshiva, both financially and by sending students, by sending the best students to my yeshiva. And he said, we will build an institution that will produce the leaders of the coming generations. And we will set a standard in Torah learning for the Jewish people. Volozhin opened, and for 70 years, it pretty much succeeded in meeting the goals of Reb Chaim. And so Volozhin was basically for the elite. The greatest minds within the Jewish world, they all ended up in Volozhin in Lithuania. There were never more than 450 students at one given time in the yeshiva. Usually it was between about 200 and 300 students that were there. And as I mentioned, really attracted all the best minds of Lithuania. And interestingly enough, we see that the fathers of many of the fathers, so Volozhin definitely produced the leaders of the Jewish world, the Rabbonim that would take the Jewish world into the future and would build their own yeshivas, and all the great yeshivas, their founders learnt in Volozhin and were trained in Volozhin. So the Vilna Gaon was correct, Reb Chaim Volozhin was correct, and this institution that Reb Chaim set up was very successful in producing great leaders in the Jewish world, and our yeshiva world today really has its roots in the first mother yeshiva, the yeshiva of Volozhin. But we see it didn't only attract the greatest minds within the religious world who would lead the religious world forward, but also attracted many great minds who became leaders of the Haskalah. Because if you had a good mind in Eastern Europe, you went to Volozhin. There was nowhere else for you to go. You had no other option. So if you wanted to go to university in Russia, so you would have to convert. And no Jews wanted to convert. And so even those that were not so religiously strong and didn't have a great level of Yerushalayim, they also ended up, if they had a good mind, they ended up in Volozhin as well. And so they would sit and learn Talmud, and they would, you know, apply their mind to the great intellectual challenge of the Talmud. There's really nothing like it to learn Gemara, to learn it properly, to learn Gemara, what we call Be'iyun, which means to focus very carefully at each different line, each different sentence, how things change, what the Havamina was, what the Maskona was, what the original idea was, and how that changed with the new idea that's been introduced, and to look at all the Perushim, all the commentaries of the Rishonim, and how they understand that particular piece of Gemara. It really is extremely intellectually challenging, probably the most intellectually challenging subject that exists in the world. So all the great minds were attracted to that, and they thrived in that environment. But many of them, they were not so strong religiously, and they ended up becoming leaders of the socialist movement. They became leaders of the Zionist movement. They became, secularists. A great example of that is Bialik, the great and famous poet, who was not very much religiously inclined. He also learned in Volozhin. But we do see that the early Maskilim, they had a strong connection to Yiddishkeit, to Judaism, and they also had a great respect for the Rabbonim and for the tradition and for our way of life, our view of the world. Those were the early Maskilim. It wasn't the same with the later Maskilim. The later leaders of the secular Jewish world and secular Jewish movements were often very anti-religious, and they had very little vestige of Jewish faith or Jewish tradition left in them. So that was one of the primary approaches to the Haskalah, one of the most significant ways of dealing with the onslaught of the Enlightenment, which had spread across Europe, was to set up the Yeshiva of Volozhin, which was the mother of all the yeshivas, and many other satellite yeshivas would open up in most of the major towns of Lithuania as a result of great people from that town going to, brilliant minds from that town going to study in Volozhin. They then would go back to their town and establish their own yeshiva throughout Lithuania. So that's the founding of the Telz yeshiva, the founding of the Slobodka yeshiva, the Novodok yeshiva, of Ponovich yeshiva, throughout Lithuania, was because they learned in Volozhin and then went back to their hometowns and established their own yeshivas. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Adventures in Jewish History with Rabbi Danny Sackstein.
We've been discussing the 17th and 18th centuries in our crash course in Jewish history. We discussed the significance of the Renaissance and how it led to the ideas of the Enlightenment, which swept across Western Europe. It took a little bit longer to get to Eastern Europe, and how the Enlightenment was really emerged first within the Jewish world in Germany, because Germany was the most liberal state of all of Europe and was the first one to grant the Jews rights. And under the leadership of Moses Mendelssohn, so the German Jewish community embraced the new modern world. And unfortunately, Mendelssohn made a great error in miscalculation and thought that it would be possible to straddle between the two worlds, and ended up being the founding father of the Reform movement, which caused great destruction within the Jewish people, because so many Jews went away from Judaism, didn't end up being Jewish as a result of following the teachings of Reform, in which the traditional values, traditional observances and practices of Judaism were totally lost, and resulted in many Jews converting to Christianity, and many Jews losing all connection to being Jewish and to having Jewish descendants. It took a little bit longer for the Enlightenment to reach Eastern Europe, and with the defeat of Napoleon in Russia, so these ideas of the French Revolution and of the New World arrived in Eastern Europe, and they too had to be dealt with. The approach in Eastern Europe was a little bit different, not to assimilate entirely and leave behind our holy tradition, but rather to be a human being outside in public, and a Jew at home. But that too was a great miscalculation. And as we see, when we look back, we see that those that embraced this philosophy very rarely had Jewish descendants that would keep up our tradition, that if one wasn't a Jew outside, it was very rare that one was a Jew inside as well. These great challenges and traumas were not the experience of Sephardi Jewry, and therefore we see Sephardi Jews are less complicated, have less baggage, have a more wholesome, pure connection to our Masorah, to our tradition, Judaism, and were not secularized as much as Ashkenazi Jews were. One of the primary ways of dealing with the Haskalah, of dealing with the Enlightenment movement, was the establishment of the Yeshiva movement, which was set up by Rav Chaim Volozhin, Talmud of the Vilna Gaon, in Volozhin in Lithuania. And Rav Chaim had the intention of building a institution that would produce the leadership of the religious Jewish world into the future. Rav Chaim was very successful at doing so and produced a large number of outstanding individuals who went through the doors of Volozhin and ended up setting up their own yeshivas. And Volozhin, the mother yeshiva, spawned many other yeshivas throughout Lithuania, and the creation and establishment of the yeshiva movement was one of the successful responses to the Haskalah to Enlightenment and ensured that the Torah would remain alive and would remain strong and would continue to be within the hearts and in the minds of the Jewish people in the 19th century. Thank you so much for listening, and we look forward to continuing in our crash course in Jewish history next Wednesday.